Hi, I'm Troy Bronsink, and this is From the Hive, a contemplative space where meditative practice meets mindful everyday living. This full episode has two parts, a conversation and a guided meditation. We're connecting you to a variety of contemplative teachers, hearing their story as well as sharing their meditative practice. If you don't have time right now to hear Jeff Gorman's story, take a look at the show notes for when the meditation portion begins, and feel free to skip ahead and come back later to the conversation. We've also learned from earlier episodes that there's a challenge moving between the passive participation of listening to the active work of sitting for guided meditation. And we're really all about helping you get a practice going. So to help with this, we've developed what we call Pocket Practices, basically the meditation-only podcast, and it's available as a separate, shorter, easy-to-share episode you can look for next week. Today's conversation is with singer-songwriter and musician Jeff Gorman. He's part of the duo Illiterate Light, and our conversation will cover things like the challenges of the business side of music, as well as the how to maintain a practice while you're on the road. And in particular, he talks about he and his bandmate Jake's approach to their music that they take from Integral Thought and actually designs a four-quadrant map for the different ways that they see both the artistic process, their internal work, the ways their business works, and kind of their vision and hopes for how their music shows up with the audience in the various venues they play in. We'll actually have links in the show notes for a visual of that integral map. So you could be doing a million different things right now. Me, for example, I'm finishing up these bitters that have taken us about 3.5 weeks to infuse. Or maybe you're raking the lawn, getting ready for some spring planting. Whatever it is, take a minute to look around, take in the light, notice the change in temperature and the season. And hopefully you'll be able to join us for the practice after the conversation.
Well, it's a trip to have Jeff Gorman with us today, part of the duo Illiterate Light. And in addition to being a musician, a contemplative, and a friend. And Jeff, great to be with you.
It's good to be with y'all. I was actually this just kind of came to mind. Not to jump right into things here, but yeah, y'all are in Cincinnati, and I was taking a moment centering down here, and one of the memories that kind of shot into my brain right away was one of the, I think, Troy, the first show that Illiterate Light played as a duo. We'd been a trio for a few months, and then our bassist quit the band, and we kind of experimentally became a duo at that festival. That's Adjust right. Your Eyes Festival in 2015. It was October of 2015, and we played at Cincy by the Slice, and we've really adjusted and evolved over the past couple of years, but there's some sort of funky little, sweet spot in my heart for Cincy, because I guess that was really the first iteration of this new chapter of Illiterate Light. So
I don't think I'd realize that was the first night that just you played as a duo. That was great.
It just popped in. Yep.
You held folks together too. It was good. It was a fun room.
We said, let's try to, be loud and sound like the Flaming Lips and have a good time.
There you go. And you did all the above, and we got pizza by the slice.
That's right. By the
slice. That was good stuff. Don't remember the beer being that great. I don't remember the beer selection being.
It can improve.
Man, so you've been playing, just to give folks kind of an idea, you've been playing music for quite a while in a couple different iterations. You want to kind of just give us a little background of
certainly I initially started out as a drummer. I kind of come from a long line of drummers. My grandfather was a jazz drummer, my uncle was a rock drummer for a really awesome band for about 25 years, the Black Crowes. Mm-hmm. And so I got to grow up going to a lot of their shows, and then my older brother was a drummer. I started drumming in middle school, and eventually wanted to start writing music. So switched over to guitar, played in a bunch of different bands in high school and college. In college, I formed this band with some really good friends of mine called Money Cannot Be Eaten, which was a line from a Cree Indian poem or prophecy, which some folks may have seen. It's after the last tree has been cut down, after the last fish has been caught and after the last river has been poisoned, will we realize that money cannot be eaten? And so we were kind of a, you know, college,
just kind of a lighthearted band then.
Yeah, very. Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, college.
No, I remember seeing y'all play, I think, at Wild Goose Festival.
That's right. Yeah. Yep.
And did you guys ride, like you guys, I think you rode to the festival on your bikes. Do I remember that right?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. We were part of a touring, a community based out of Harrisonburg, Virginia, which is in the Shenandoah Valley, and kind of a new monastic community. And every summer we would do this thing called the Petrol Free Jubilee Carnival Tour. There were many names that kind of ended up spurring along, but that was probably the basic Petrol Free Jubilee. And it was basically a social justice music camp on wheels for anywhere from 2 to 4 weeks, where it was, you know, probably 8 to 30 people at any given point biking around and playing shows and, you know, kind of living off the land in certain ways, a hybrid of that and dumpster diving and all that fun stuff. So that
like
was money.
Shane Claiborne meets Green Belt meets food trucks kind of thing.
That's an accurate description. So that was money cannot be eaten. We were working on, my bandmates and I were working on a farm and trying to do music at the same time. And that was, exciting and exhausting. And, so that band eventually dissolved and I spent about a year, doing some more, solo stuff and kind of community building in Harrisonburg, a lot of working at a small, kind of soup kitchen community center. And then I formed Illiterate Light with my best friend Jake, who was also in Money Cannot Be Eaten. And like I mentioned, we were a trio for a while, and then that morphed into a duo. And it took a little bit of adjusting to figure out how we were going to do that, because that wasn't what we were planning on. But now we are pretty excited about our, you know, limited lineup here. But one of the ways I guess we do that is that we still wanted to retain a full sound and have a exciting, you know, show and performance and have this kind of high energy thing. And so Jake stands up while he drums and often will, you know, sometimes be shirtless or wear a crop top or something that will, you know, engage people.
Engage
sexual
the people.
Yeah. Exactly. And then I play guitar and sing, and then I've got a kind of a contraption that allows me to actually play bass with my feet. It looks like an old organ pedal, and it runs into a synthesizer, and then I run that through a bass amp. And so I'm kind of tapping along bass lines while we're playing. And so it still has this big full, and then we both sing and, you know, kind of dance and do weird stuff like that. But that's, I guess, probably, you know, in a nutshell where Illiterate Light's live show is at right now.
It's amazing. So when you're in the studio, do you separate that stuff out and kind of work them track at a time?
We're currently figuring that out. For a while, it was kind of like in studio, we were more of like a full band. And then, you know, when we play live, it was kind of, you know, would alter and be stripped down. So I'd play string bass on recordings and things like that. And recently we've been in the studio, we've been doing a lot more of just kind of capturing that raw energy that Jake and I seem to have together. So I'm playing foot bass live for a lot of stuff. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I'll go back and, you know, punch in a couple things here and there, but, and Jake stands, you know, when he plays in the studio. So we've definitely kind of shifted, and our studio sound and our live sound are starting to be a little more married, which is I think pretty cool.
That's awesome. The so, you know, while all this is going on and you're developing that particular sound, and there's a lot to the work of running a band, right? So there's kind mm-hmm. of already kind of two things folks have to develop when you're on the road. You're not just, you're working on your own band chemistry and music, but then you're also working on a business, right? And so sometimes these conversations we have here are this kind of intersection of like the contemplative work and then the business work, but you've got like two external outputs, the art and the business. And then right. underneath that is running a contemplative thread as well.
Yeah, there's a lot going on there. When you start to pull it apart, the big the learning curve for us has been that more business side of things. It's certainly less exciting, less sexy, but it's, you know, just as important. So Jake and I, we split things up into the artistic and the creative side. And then we also wear different hats and have kind of managed roles managerially. He's basically the booking agent and I'm the promoter. And, I do the finances, all that jazz. Mm-hmm. That's been one way that we've kind of really tried to be aware of the fact that when you're trying to do this with your life, you do have to make a living and pay rent and all those sorts of things. The contemplative piece, has been interesting. How would I say that?
Well, just to offer a little background, right? So we know each other through some of the work of the Living School. I know you've spent a good bit of time as well with Cynthia Bergeau's Wisdom School. And then we may or may not kind of dabble some in Integral and some of Ken Wilber's work. So all of that's kind of going on in there. Would you say there was a time where you saw it meet up, or did it kind of evolve?
It's at this. I'll start by naming that. For a long time, I wasn't quite sure how to, like, I was doing my contemplative practice, right? And mm-hmm. I was, probably for 2 or 3 years now, I've been a practitioner of centering prayer. And then, of course you kind of dabble in a lot of other things, but that's been kind of the go-to. You're kind of doing that behind the scenes, and then in front of the scenes, you're, kind of writing rock music and all these other things that are just great and that you love. I think a little bit of my insecurity comes from the genre or vibe or the way we kind of paint the word contemplative. Because there's almost, you think about contemplative music and you don't immediately think of the Flaming Lips.
Frank Zappa.
I love that music, and that seems to be what always comes out of me when I get quiet. So I think for a long time I was like, if we're talking about identification here, I don't really know that I'd identify as a contemplative musician. And is that what I am? And I certainly have a contemplative practice and I play rock. How do these two things live together? And I could sit there and start to think about artists that I'm like, now that's a contemplative musician, And, we've talked about Leonard Cohen before, songs, he just kind of takes you into that space, and there's this whole, and it's great. There's been a little bit of an insecurity, and I've never been quite sure how to marry the two. I think recently, for me, I'm just kind of becoming okay with the fact that I don't have to write these, not every song has to be this incredibly introspective, kind of quiet, bring people in sort of thing. Like, mm-hmm. It's okay that you kind of like to freak out. I think, you'd mentioned a little bit of the Wilbur and the Integral stuff. To get back to, kind of how, quote unquote, how I identify with some of this, I've come to find a little bit of comfort in being like, I don't know if our music is contemplative, but I certainly think that it's trying to be integral. And for some reason, there's a little bit of a different flavor in my mouth between contemplative music and integral music. And I really love both and hope to be living in both worlds. But I think if there was kind of like a, if somebody said, is your music contemplative? I'd probably say, I don't know, but I think it's integral.
So let's just unpack that vocabulary for listeners. So some folks, without getting into a lot of it, Ken Wilber, right, is for ages working out of Boulder and the, what is it, the Center for Integral Living?
He's got the Integral Institute, and you know, he's been writing since the 70s. And yeah, you're right. It's a whole kind of world there. So in a nutshell, you know, you could consider him a bit of a map maker, if you will, or a philosopher. He does a lot with developmental psychology. So
I want to go ahead and let's try this out. I think sure. If we could help folks, the aqua map that you made that has these four quadrants, I think is a really interesting way to understand, you use the word identification a lot. And then I also know, like in that Gurdjieffian sense, right, to identify, there's a freedom from identification. That's part of this process too. So I just think there's something interesting in just to put some of my own kind of commentary on it and then to ask you to unpack it how it specifically works with Illiterate Light and kind of your own sense of creative mission and agency and all that. I think there, when we were talking about these layers, if you think about, in your case, the rock musicians, the composer, the performer, so we already know that there's a difference between those two headspaces or those two kind of frame of mind in relationship to what you're creating and how it fits in the world. And then there's obviously the business side of that. So somebody is thinking through, and there are market factors that determine where you're going to play, certain A&R support that comes behind your work that are connected to market factors. And then, and then there's this kind of like, who is Jeff? Who is Jake underneath that? Because Jeff and Jake aren't simply the creative force or the ones riding the market wave, but there's something happening within you. And then you go to all those kind of meta questions of like bands that can play the room. And so, you know, there's some great stuff that, David Byrne's done on just kind of his own evolution as a writer from CBGB all the way to stadium rock. And like that there's you're growing with the room, but then you're also learning how to hold a container, the size of a arena. And, and so all of that's kind of going on there. And so then this map, I think, is an interesting way of how somebody at your point in your creative career describes that. And I'd love our listeners to hear that a little bit. So just first kind of give me a 40,000 foot view of what those four quadrants are kind of visually, and then we can dive into each of them a little bit.
Cool. That sounds great. Yeah. So the, you know, the four quadrant approach was one of the first times where I felt like it helped me sift through and see the interconnectedness of all those things that you just named. It was like, there are so many things going on, as an aspiring artist in the, you know, 21st century in America. And how am I going to kind of weave all these things together? So, you know, the four quadrant approach, if you can imagine four quadrants, and this is great to explain this because, you know, it's all these things that are in your brain and then you get to articulate it. So you can take any event or a system or spirituality or religion or, government or anything. You can look at anything with this four quadrant approach. So the top half of this four quadrant approach, the upper two quadrants, contain the individual side of things. The bottom half contain the collective side of things. On the left hand, so now we're talking about the upper left and the lower left, we have the inner or the subjective side of things.
So the experience from within.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. We're still within. So to break that down a little bit, so on the upper left, it's the experience from inside the individual. The way that works out is that, you know, Jake and I, my bandmate and I, we're both individuals, part of this, you know, team together. And so there are things that we're paying attention to that I put in that quadrant. That would be things like, you know, like contemplation and inner cultivation, meditation and prayer, you know, rest and family time, personal well-being, growth. You know, so when Jake and I do things like a check-in, we'll kind of run around the horn with these four quadrants and say, how's everything going in this realm for us? You know, do you feel like you're kind of growing as an individual right now? Or, you know, how's our sobriety on the road? You know, are we enjoying the band? What's our meditation practice like? To jump down, so we're still looking at the individual, you know, subjective inner side of things. If we're jumping down to the lower left, we're still on the inside, but it's the inside of Jake and I as a collective. How's our friendship? How's our band culture and our music community? What other kind of micro communities are we part of as artists? Are they diverse? Is it a bunch of, you know, white indie rock dudes? Are we engaging with, you know, different forms of, you know, music? And what's our kind of band, our shared philosophy? You know, this is where we're kind of getting more into the cultural elements, but we're still inside because not all of that stuff is necessarily numbers tangible, right? We're not talking, that's not yep. like our business model, you know, getting somebody to fund an album for us. That's like, that's our in, that's the inside of Illiterate Light. I'm just going to jump over to the lower right now, which okay. is,
so we're moving kind of counterclockwise.
Exactly. Yeah. This yeah. is a little, yeah.
It's good.
Yeah. But it's a this is a really easy one to look at for a band or a mm-hmm. business, mm-hmm. Because this is the realm of the, we're in the collective realm, but mm-hmm. this is, we're moving more objective rather than the previous realm was that subjective, and kind of inner side. This is the outside of the collective. So now we're starting to look at actual numbers, right? And stats, and what are record sales? How many tickets do we sell in a particular city? How much money do we make off merch in Richmond versus Nashville versus Cincinnati versus Brooklyn? You know, we're naming goals and charting them. How many albums have we released this year? Looking at things like our sustainability and ecological impact. You know, this is, for me, this is the realm of it's a little more tangible and it's a little more measurable, chartable. And you can see how there's a direct connection between the inner collective and the exterior collective, right?
Yeah.
But it's been helpful to actually kind of still separate them and kind of put them on paper like that. I'll just kind of finish up here. So to jump up to the upper right. So again, we're kind of moving in this funny way. We're back in the individual side of things, but this is, we're on the right hand of our, you know, map, and this is the objective side of things. So we're kind of looking at, I'm looking at myself on an individual level, but it's less about the subjective side of things and more about the objective. So I'm looking at, you know, how much have I been able to practice this week? That's a big part of where we're at right now. And, you know, kind of devoting my week in a way where I'm saying, all right, 20 minutes a day, I'm running scales, and 20 minutes a day, I'm, you know, doing vocal warmups and stuff. Improving our talent level. These, again, in my understanding of this, are things that are kind of measurable, right? It's directly related to the inner subjective side, but it's more on the exterior. You can kind of pinpoint it a little bit more. What's Jake and I's workload look like on a given week for the band? Is he carrying all of the weight doing 80% and I'm kind of slacking along doing 20% because I've been doing other things? So that's a little bit of a, that's been one way that we've applied this four quadrant approach to our band. There are people that are doing this with medicine, with business, with psychology. It's a way to kind of unpack things and start to see the interconnectivity between them all.
Why do we only see Either all black or white, good or bad, red or blue, me or you, ain't it time that we move on? Yes! We're all different. We all got our own thing going on.
Yeah, it's beautiful. So to play with this for a little bit, you know, we share a similar background where, like, there was... I don't know if it's how similar it is, but in some of my own background, if a person of faith was involved in art, there was a question of how the art was being leveraged for a faith outcome, right? And so there was there's, you know, these questions of secular and Christian was the case, you know, in my tradition, but this sense of like, does this music create a certain type of result? And then I think when you look at your previous band, Money Cannot Be Eaten, there's an earnestness there of like the band's impact on the earth, but also the impact of your work as kind of a revolutionary band, somebody inciting subvertive prophetic imagination sort of a thing.
Does the war make sense? Did you graduate? Do you appreciate your country?
Yeah, it was kind of like that was one of the conversations that would be happening for that band was like, you know, are we allowed to just write a love song? You know, like,
that's great.
That was a question.
What it grows into then is like, what is it that is a reasonable outcome? So, at the Hive, we just started this year long cohort with entrepreneurs that want to see how does their contemplative practice inform entrepreneurship and how is entrepreneurship itself a type of contemplative practice, which is what that leaps into. It asks this question of not just do you have a practice that helps you stay sane, or does your team have a practice so that they stay sane or grounded or fresh, but also the question of like does the impact of your work participate in the groundedness of life? Especially for spiritual folks from kind of Western traditions, there's an earnestness that might pull the freedom out of the art. The earnestness of like, can I leverage this art toward a greater good? Mm-hmm. And what I hear you describing is that it's okay to ask, like you're separating those greater goods, I'm using air quotes now, into different quadrants. So in one sense, a greater good is this going to be a feasible participation in community economics? Is this going to actually fund? I know you're engaged and going to be married, and then you guys, for just you and Jake and your lives, your separate lives, like you guys have bills to pay and ways to go. Is this, as I keep growing up, is this going to make that work? That's one visible question, you know? But then there are these other questions of like, how does this participate in? Am I putting words in your mouth? Like, how does this participate in the world's transformation, or how does this participate in growth? Say a little bit more about that.
No, you're not putting words in my mouth. That's very accurate. I was fortunate enough to be able to learn under a songwriter that I really respect. And one of the takeaways I always remember coming back to him was not every song has to save the world. And, that's given me a lot of freedom to be authentic and write silly songs and write songs that are I'm trying to connect that I do have a deep yearning and desire for the transformation of our culture and of the world and of systems and I want to participate in that. And I also like writing love songs that never even mention that.
So this is really good. I'd like to keep playing here a little bit. I think that there's a, if we can play with another Wilbur term, a non-dual space where being and the becoming aren't at odds with each other. So, I mean, to me, this would be a great chapter in a book. Not every song has to save the world. Like, that's a great hook because there is this notion that either I'm writing a song to save the world or I'm, you know, refueling or you know, right. like I'm doing something that's good for me now. You know, we have activists that are at the Hive quite a bit, right? And this question of like, you're out there and it's depleting and then you come back here and it's, reinvigorating. And honestly, that's not sustainable. Like out there needs to also have a vulnerable reinvigoration and that in here, there's a place for vulnerability to actually do some of the weeping that you just can't do when you're out there. Like there's a, it's happening in both places. Can you give an example of a time where you felt like you were feeding that dualistic tendency too much and that this this approach helped you kind of soften some of those edges and reintegrate?
I'd probably hone in again a little bit more on this. Certainly when you start to engage and interact with more liberal progressive communities where there's a real beauty to the social justice inclusivity. I'll say that, you know, in college and after college and still, that's a lot of my world and a lot of my people. It can be very missional in a really passionate way. And I think I would kind of re-hone in on this fact that, you know, I've carried around a little bit of insecurity of knowing how some of my writing fits into that when it doesn't have a mission to save the world. you know, we've got a song called Like a Peach and that we wrote in 2015. And it's
I've grilled to that song. I've had that in the back porch. Yep.
It's a really fun, you know, it's a fun song and it's absurd and it's more in that Zappa style of things. And the basic kind of idea of the song is we're just toying around with, you know, modern dating norms and, you know, kind of like, you know, millennials going to bars and trying to pick each other up and stuff. Not that that's like something that's particular to millennials, but that was kind of, you know, who we're kind of
picking
writing
on.
For.
Yeah, sure.
And it's just a goofy song. It's fun. And now when we play it live, it's like, there's like this heavy metal section where we're just, you know, screaming and kind of going nuts. And then the verse kind of picks up and it's real jolly and jangly and kind of silly. And then we hit the chorus and we kind of, Jake and I go back and forth between, I'm basically the voice of reason kind of narrating this like dance floor interaction that's happening between these two people. And then Jake is kind of this voice of like almost the unconscious, like impulsivity. And he's kind of like, so I'm saying like, I recognize the absurdity. And Jake's over there like, you smell like soap, and saying all these like weird, you know, like, oh, we're sweating all over each other. It's kind of fun and playful, you know. There's no mission to that other than to have fun. I hope that's part of the revolution. I don't know that I'm able to kind of sit here and say, here's an example of when it was this, you know, it was more egoic or it was more either or dualistic or whatever. And here's how this kind of solved it. But I know that I've just gotten much more comfortable being like, there's so much room, you know, I think that one of the things that, honestly, having a contemplative practice and a lot of, you know, just reading of different things is that there's so much room and there's so much space, mm-hmm. and it's so freeing. If we write a song that's more politically charged, we've got this new song that's not out yet. It's kind of like a, you know, an homage to Neil Young or something. It's called "I Want to Leave America," and it's not like anti-patriotic or anything. It's just kind of just this feeling of like, man, there's I can't really believe what's going on in our political climate right now. You know, it's. There's a comfortability just moving between worlds now and being like, yeah, an artist has the ability to write a song that's weird and like goofy and also observational and then like serious and reflective and emotional and then totally political. And there's just space for it all. Hmm. I don't know where that's really coming from, but it's just been like, yeah.
Just in one of our mindfulness classes a couple of days ago, we were reading the Rumi poem, "The Guest House," right? Of just welcome, welcome it at the door laughing. And I think what I hear you saying is that art can do all of that as well. And your practice is teaching you that.
Yeah.
You welcome it all at the door laughing and give it space.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's a really good way of pointing it or putting it. Sometimes when you're in the throes of your ego, you know, and, mm-hmm. and, or really whatever it is, overtaken by your own thing, you can create some great art. And
yeah, yeah.
Sometimes when you start to move into the realm of kind of detaching a little bit and stepping back, it really changes your process. I'm still, this is kind of coming up for me right now. So
I want to stick with this.
Articulate it. But it's almost like in some ways you're like, it's like your ego can almost be, you know, like your egoic operating system. If you kind of have the ability to somewhat move between that and a more, open, space, and you know what it feels like to be in your ego and stuff, it's almost like getting high and, mm-hmm. And kind of having this drug that helps you produce your material. And then when you start to step away from that, sometimes there can be like I'm not really sure if I know how to produce in this new space. Has that been something that you've ever, do you kind of catch what I'm saying a little bit?
Yeah. So there's this, to play through this some, as we develop a self-consciousness, then sometimes that the pleasure pain system inside of our bodies creates a way of coping with that, what we're conscious to in terms of pain or confusion or anxiety. And that, for a lot of creatives, that becomes a generative space. You create out of that place of suffering, you create out of that place of ecstasy. And then in a practice, you begin to be more aware that who I am in that place of suffering or who I am in that place of ecstasy isn't the whole story. Right. And so there's an openness to a wider story. And on that process, then there begins to be, I would say in my experience, then an insecurity of, like for me, I can move over to guilt. Like, is it right for me to then drop into this story that I know is incomplete? But then a little other question is just like, I'm just aware of it. And so how am I, like, I'm conscious of it now. Do I want to drop into it? And so it starts to make room for almost like the benefits of an alter ego for a performer, yeah. right? And this, sure. And I think it moves in a couple other ways too. This is where it'd be interesting to play. Is I think that when that musicians are often and performers are doing a type of energy work where they aren't just doing that with themselves, but they're doing that with the room. They're feeling the shift in the room, and that gets wider, and that capacity to do that gets wider and wider and wider, to where we say that person's captivating. How did Bono stand on that stage and hold all of our attention?
Right.
And knowing that that's not just something because he had a lot of money and a lot of lights on him. There's a magnetism that somebody has trained and learned how to pull the field that way. Then all of a sudden to go like, there's so many different fields I'm pulling and participating with. I think another interview one day would be interesting to ask this kind of like a Kanye West type of character. At a certain point, Kanye isn't playing the room. He's now playing pop culture. Like he can actually, he's riding a wave that's different than simply an arena. It's like an ability to move through pop culture, which also, you know, politicians and others can do in powerful ways.
Yeah. I mean, you mentioned, you know, earlier, David Byrne and I think you were referring to, his book, How Music Works.
Yeah. Yep.
Where he really, which was huge for me. I'm a huge Talking Heads fan, and so is Jake, my bandmate. And that book is really wonderful. But I loved when he talked about his writing process and it's so true that, you know, there's so often for us a particular environment that on the back end, you know, when we're writing or rehearsing a song, we're thinking like, this is totally gonna go over in this DIY punk house show. You know, it's like, this is, we're kind of writing for that environment.
Sure.
And he goes through that as far as saying like, you know, the way Gregorian chants are written is a result of the environment of a huge chapel where the reverb echo lasts for 5 or 6 seconds. And you're not going to have a really rhythmic line like, I love God, I love God, I love God, I love God, you know, because it would just be so muddy. It wouldn't. So you have these long held out notes that sweep in and out. So I don't know where I'm going with that other than it's certainly part of our process. Is thinking about where that music will be, you know, received. But then when you're in the actual throes of it and you're playing a show, there is a lot of that, I think you called it, I don't know if it's energy management or whatever it is, but you have this this collective force, a show, whether it's, you know, whether it's folk or hip hop or or rock or whatever, and to be able to start to harness that, you know, that's been a big learning curve for Jake and I, was that every city that we would go to, being a young aspiring, you know, really DIY ethos type of band, every room that we play in, no one has any idea who we are. And so we have to captivate attention. And one way that you do that is by being kind of chaotic and loud and weird and different, you know. But then once people are drawn in, we would have certain shows, and we still do every now and then, where it's 30 or 40 minutes and it's so high octane to get your attention. But after that 30 or 40 minutes, we never went down. We just kept it up the whole time, and you feel burnt out afterwards. And you're like, so now we're starting to learn that managing of energy is that once people are drawn in, you can go on a journey with an audience, you know, even if it's 10 people, and you can go low and you can go to like a dark space and hold the tension there and then brighten over the course of a verse and then hit a chorus that totally releases and we're all feeling that together. That sort of playing the room, as you put, and kind of interacting with each other on stage and then taking a group of people that are standing there watching us for the first time. That's been a really exciting part of kind of our band experience so far.
It's awesome. One last question I want to ask you before we move to the next stuff. It's, what is it like when you're on the road to hold a practice? How do you pull that off?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's, you know, it's morphed a bit, and I appreciated hearing Science Mike. I think you had him.
That's right. Yeah. I think that was because of a question you had for me. You were like, "Hey, while you're doing this, what do you?"
I heard you ask that question, and I thought, I was like, "Man, I wonder if he's asking that because we had that conversation in Albuquerque." He did a great job of starting to go into it because he was on a book tour when he answered that question. But for me, you know, it's not having, especially where we're at right now. I imagine this will be the case even as things, you know, move into different realms for us as a band. But right now, on a week tour or 2 week tour or even 3 day mini tour up the coast, there's no personal space whatsoever when you're touring in a Subaru Forester, and most of the places you play don't have a green room. So you've kind of got the bathroom and like public parks for your, like, this is my zone for a few minutes.
Mm-hmm.
So the way that it has kind of worked out is that when I'm home, like I am right now, centering prayer as a practice is fairly easy to access, and I have a little bit more space. For a while, I was trying to have a contemplative practice that, you know, if you're going to do a sit for 20 minutes or something, you're kind of taking up a certain amount of space. And if you're in somebody's living room and they've got roommates that you don't know that are kind of coming in and out, you kind of end up, you know. For me, I kind of got to the point where I was doing that a little bit, and I felt like a little intrusive.
It was a little presumptuous,
space.
Yeah.
Yeah, a little presumptuous. Yeah. Kind of
rock stars,
you know,
in town needs his meditation room.
Totally, yeah. So I was just like, I'm gonna kind of work with my environment here. And for me, what that looks like is at home, centering prayer is the go-to, and then on the road, a walking meditation, which is very loosely defined for me right now. It's simply a matter of it could be from walking from, you know, during load in, carrying all of our gear, and we, you know, 5 trips back and forth to the car from the club to the car, or going on a 10 or 15 minute walk around the block and just kind of feeling out the city that we're in. And what it looks like is, you know, really connecting my breath to my steps, centering down, being in that place. You know, when you're on the road, you can move so fast that it's like you can get back after 2 weeks and be like, I literally am looking at my odometer and we just went 4,000 miles and I don't even know what happened.
Yeah. And yeah, there's that John O'Donohue quote, you've traveled too far over false ground and now your soul has come to take you back.
Oh my gosh. That's great. Yeah. I really prefer to be there. You know, I'd really prefer to, in Nashville or New Orleans or something, even if it's for a short time, it's much nicer to sink in. So it's really not very, very technical for me. I know that there's other folks that have kind of narrowed it down much more beautifully, but for me, it's, you know, inhaling for 3 steps and exhaling for 4 steps or wherever I'm at that day, and kind of just absorbing the block that I'm on and paying attention. You know, it's very simple, but it's just, for me, a lot of this can't be overly complex because I'm off, you know, on the road, you're just exhausted. And it's just kind of like, I'm getting in my body, I'm breathing, I'm slowing down. I'm not here to fly through it. I actually kind of want to be present for this whole fun, you know, thing. It's really a privilege and a joy to be able to go to different cities and play music, even if you don't make much money doing it. So I really actually want to enjoy that process rather than try to fly through it.
That's great. Well, we're going to take a break here and then come back and have you guide us in a... just a way of paying attention. Is there anything you'd like to kind of set up before we take that break? Anything you're anticipating we'll do together?
Yeah. So I think what we'll do is we'll do a brief, you know, depending on what works best for you all, you know, 8 or 10 minute kind of centering prayer. And I'll read a little bit of poetry to lead us into that. I'm a big fan of Thomas Merton's work. And so we'll read a little bit of that. We'll kind of go over some just basic guidelines. We'll sink in and we'll go from there.
Sounds great. Well, Jeff Gorman, this has been a blast. Thanks for taking the time to chat.
You're very welcome. Thanks, Troy.
That's great. Good. We'll be right back.
Hey there, you've been listening to From the Hive, a contemplative space where meditative practice meets mindful everyday living. I'm your host, Troy Bronsink, founder and director of The Hive, a center for contemplation, art, and action. We're a nonprofit located in the North Side neighborhood of Cincinnati, and our secret sauce is getting people together into small groups to develop daily practices. If you're not in the Cincinnati area and would like to make classes possible for somebody else, there's ways to make donations and gift subscriptions on the website as well. We appreciate you listening and sharing this with other folks. We'll return now to the practice with Jeff Gorman, including some guided meditation and work on guitar.
Well, we're back with Jeff Gorman of Illiterate Light. Jeff, this has been great talking with you.
Yeah, you as well, Troy. Thanks so much.
That's good. Well, I'm going to push the mic aside here and just let you guide us into a practice here.
All right. So what we're going to be doing is a little brief intro to a contemplative practice called centering prayer. This is, also called the prayer of consent. In my Christian tradition, we use language of God to speak about the divine. Interpret that and understand that in whatever way suits you best. Going to run through the guidelines here. What we're going to do is choose a sacred word as the symbol of our intention to consent to God's presence and action within. You'll choose your word and I'll choose mine. And to speak briefly on that, a word could be anything from peace, hope, Abba, let go. Any of these things will do just fine. Sitting comfortably and with eyes closed, settle briefly and silently introduce the sacred word as the symbol of your consent to God's presence and action within. When engaged with your thoughts, return ever so gently to the sacred word. And for me, I always have to underline or highlight ever so gently. I like to think of the little feather kind of floating throughout the air, because I have a tendency to ping right back to that sacred word as the thoughts and emotions start to pour in. But be gentle with it. At the end of the prayer period, we'll remain in silence with our eyes closed for just a few moments. I'm going to kick this off with a little poem by one of the most prominent Catholic writers and mystics of the 20th century, Thomas Merton. A yellow flower, light in spirit, sings by itself for nobody. A golden spirit, light and emptiness, sings without a word by itself. Let no one touch this gentle sun in whose dark eye someone is awake. No light, no gold, no name, no color, and no thought, O wide awake. A golden heaven sings by itself, a song to nobody. My worship is a blue sky and 10,000 crickets in the deep wet hay of the field. My vow is the silence under their song. We're going to begin now. as thoughts and sensations and emotions emerge, return ever so gently to your sacred word. For many of us, some sense of fear or anger or shame tends to creep up during this time. Return ever so gently to the sacred word. We're simply increasing our capacity for space right now. Let things go, even if they come right back. Return to the sacred word. If you're anything like me, sometimes it's the same thought or same to-do list that just keeps nagging, and the contemplative practice will go by and you've returned to the sacred word 10,000 times, and that's just fine. Thoughts include body sensations, which often for me means an itch somewhere on my nose or my ear, drawing my attention away. The itch will be there when the prayer period is over. Return to the sacred word. In regards to technique, if you find yourself getting sleepy, like sometimes when I'm doing this practice at 4 a.m. after a show, getting into a different city, it's okay to blink your eyes. I know I just said that body sensations need to be let go, but it's also okay if you're finding yourself getting sleepy to stay awake and stay alert during this, to blink your eyes and return ever so gently to the sacred word. I've got my guitar sitting right here, so I'm going to begin to play a little bit of some music here, and over the next minute or two, we'll begin transition back into our normal day-to-day lives, hopefully with a little bit more space and a little bit more compassion and gentleness. Not to say that all this contemplative stuff is just trying to make us passive by any means. But I think it does create a certain amount of inner space. So over the next minute or two, go ahead and start to open your eyes, sink back in. May you go in peace and patience. Thank you, friends.
Jeff Gorman, thank you so much for sharing this time with us.
You're welcome. Thanks, Troy. Keep up all the incredible work y'all are doing at The Hive. I'm hoping to be in Cincinnati this March.
Yep, hope to see you then. And meanwhile, the folks can see more about your work through the show notes and other things. And so... cool. Look forward to hearing more from you and from Illiterate Light. So take care, man. Awesome.
Thank you. You as well. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Hey, I'm Troy Bronsink, and this has been From the Hive, a contemplative space where meditative practice meets mindful everyday living. Today, we've been talking with musician and songwriter and touring artist Jeff Gorman. You can check out the show notes for ways to connect to his band Illiterate Light and more of his work, and be on the lookout next week for the Pocket Practice. From the Hive is produced by Joey Taylor. Take a deep breath. Enjoy the day.